So let's take a couple breaths, and we're going to need to incorporate the background and the sounds of the choir today, and let that just be. We'd like to begin the class by using the sound of Om to take us into our receptive state. So we'll begin by taking three breaths. And with a deep in-breath. Are you familiar with the teachings of Satchidananda in the Bhagavad Gita?
Not a whole lot. I mean, I've read it. I mean, is he also part of Indigo Yoga in Yogaville?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, mm-hmm. Satchidananda founded Yogaville, mm-hmm. down right. south of Charlottesville. Right. He passed.
He did pass, yeah. Mm-hmm. So I've been there a number of times.
Great, me too. Mm-hmm. We're going to look at the Bhagavad Gita today and use it as a path for personal spiritual transformation. The background of the Bhagavad Gita is, remember this, it's set on a battlefield. Two great forces opposing each other, about to go to war. Metaphorically, one is the force of evil, we're all evil. Others are good, they're all good in the metaphor. The leader of the forces of good is named Arjuna, Prince I've always mispronounced that. It's Arjuna. Arjuna. Mm. Mm-hmm. Prince Arjuna.
Oh, that's going to be hard to change.
Prince Arjuna. And it turns out in the metaphor that his charioteer is an incarnation of the Absolute, the Deity, God, incarnation, named Krishna. There are various incarnations of God in the Indian tradition. In this case, it's Lord Krishna. When Arjuna is ridden up in his chariot between the two forces, and in those days they had bows and arrows and spears, no guns. So the forces gathered before fighting, made a lot of noise with their conch horns and drums. He drove out in front of them to survey the field. And he looked across at the evil army, and there were his cousins, his teachers, his relatives, and on the good side were other cousins and relatives and teachers. It was a civil war. Arjuna, in great state of intellectual consternation, couldn't bring himself to fight, although he was a warrior. That was his duty. That was his to do. But he didn't want to kill his teachers and his family members. He said, if I kill them, I'll go to hell. And if I'm victorious, it won't mean anything to me. He threw down his bow, which was called Gandiva, mighty bow, and told Lord Krishna, I won't fight. And in the next instance, all of the Bhagavad Gita unfolds in that instant time as Lord Krishna gives advice to Prince Arjuna. The advice is useful for us. In the metaphor, we are Arjuna. We are Arjuna. We could use this advice. You could think of Lord Krishna as being the Christ consciousness in you, awakening, accessing it. It was what it's ours to do. Did you all go to the sermon today?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We heard from Stacy the recommendation that we act. That we act. We act. The Bhagavad Gita is going to give us some suggestions about acting, the nature of acting, how we determine what's ours to do. Remember, Arjuna had a big problem deciding what was his to do. He couldn't figure it out. Sometimes we're in the same boat. We're going to jump in to the middle of chapter 2, slokas 48 and 49. Turns out that these slokas have something to do with acting, figuring out what is ours to do. There are various aspects to it. We'll first start with one aspect. Questions before we start? Here we go. Bhagavad Gita 48. Equanimity of mind is yoga. Do everything, Arjuna, centered in that equanimity. Renouncing all attachments, you'll enjoy an undisturbed mind in success or failure. Each of these slokas is packed with so much. So much. Equanimity of mind is yoga. This is yoga in the larger sense, not of postures, but rather of yoga as a spiritual tradition, which includes the postures to help bring ourselves to equanimity and breathing practices. It includes karma yoga, dedicating ourselves to service, jhana yoga, which is studying the scriptures and becoming more and more wise, bhakti yoga, which is through devotion, becoming more and more in a state of equanimity.
How do you define equanimity?
Equanimity?
Here.
Take a big breath. Peace.
Peace.
That was
the word.
Peace. We take that big breath. Some upsetting things come to us. We're worried about this. We're worried about that. Spiritual peace. We're not so much worried about peace on earth. We're worried about peace coming from us. Not even necessarily inside of us, but rather peace being the energy that we bring to life. So that anyone in our presence experiences peace just by being near us or thinking about us. The sloka says, equanimity of mind is yoga. implying that we have minds, and minds need some attention and some work. Yoga's going to have, the Bhagavad Gita will have some recommendations for dealing with our mind. First step, of course, is to realize we have minds. Everyone has a mind, right? Or everyone has thoughts. Yes. And the next step is to hear that we are not the mind. That's not who we are. We are not our thoughts. We just have them. Like, I've got fingernails, got fingers, and I've got thoughts. There's something that we have. I take care of my hands, I wash them. It's useful to learn how to take care of our mind and our thoughts so that our mind can serve us. Because our mind is often the source of upset and an untranquil state. And a properly washed mind can support our equanimity. And the study of yoga is how to experience that state of equanimity more and more and more. And there's a word for it in Sanskrit, nirvana. Nirvana, which means to blow out. I believe that's the root of the word, nirvana, blow out. So that our mind is not a source of trouble to us and doesn't impact the equanimity that we were born with. And somehow we lost track of it as we got civilized. Krishna says, do everything, Arjuna, centered in that equanimity. Do everything. Do everything, whatever act you do, do it from the equanimity, not from your upset, not from your anger, not from your fear, not even from your enthusiasm. No, no. All of those mind states can lead you astray. Now, we know this. Have you ever wanted something in a shop, for example? You just wanted that diamond ring or that new gadget. I like gadgets. Just really wanted it. And finally, you were able to get it. With great enthusiasm, you went and got it. Then what happened? Well, you had to take care of it. You had to worry about someone stealing it. You had to worry about it breaking. Should I get a maintenance policy or not? And you didn't even use it that much, and it sat there and you looked at it. Enthusiasm is not always the best state of mind for acquiring things or fulfilling desires. The Gita would recommend equanimity. Equanimity. Acquiring this, will this really serve me? Will it allow me to be of greater service to others? Mm-hmm. Having this, will it help empower me to serve others, my family, more? And from that equanimity of mind, when we acquire things, in a way we don't own them anymore. We just have them and use them for the purpose for which they were meant, not to satisfy desires and enthusiasms or fears. What will people think if I don't get this? So. Equanimity of mind is yoga. Do everything yoga centered in that equanimity, renouncing all attachments. There's a big one. Most of us are attached to our things. I'm attached to my car, for example, but that's okay. Attachments, renouncing attachments, being able to have things lightly with equanimity, so that no matter what the things are, we recognize that we don't own them. Not really. We just use them. God owns them. Even our children. We don't own our children. The universe owns our children. We're just here to do a good job bringing them up, supporting them, and giving them love. And hopefully offering advice when it's requested and not when it's not needed.
I think what you're saying about holding things lightly is important, because even you can even become attached to peace. You know, that state of mind, and it's like the whole thing of fighting for peace. You know, you're trying so hard to become peaceful that you're caught in the process.
You start thinking about it and realize you're not.
And so you get caught in the process of trying to find peace. You know?
Trying to figure it out.
Yeah, right.
Just like poor Arjuna on the battlefield. He just wanted a peaceful life to do what his to do, which is be a warrior. And here he was, couldn't figure it out.
So
he lost his
peace.
Giving
up all attachments means sort of giving up even the attachment to peace.
And giving up the attachment to ourselves, our bodies as well. We don't own our bodies, contrary to common misunderstanding. Mm-hmm. They're owned by the universe. We're just temporary custodians of our bodies while we're here. Like St. Francis said about his body, he said, "My body is like my donkey." He said, "I wash it, I feed it, but I ride it." It doesn't ride me, even our bodies. We do have things, and to the extent that there's an attachment to things, applying some emotional mind way of holding things, we have the potential of losing our equanimity when events occur and those things that we have change state, become something else, go away, so on. Renouncing all attachments. So that's the spiritual teaching. You'll see it repeated again and again, also in many other spiritual teachings. If you do that, you'll enjoy an undisturbed mind in success or failure. Most of us are attached to success, aren't we? And afraid of failure. Interestingly, if we look deep within ourselves, I'm guessing we're not really personally so worried about failure, but what will our family think if we fail? What will our friends think if we fail? Will they think that I am a failure? Steve Jobs, who created now the most valuable company in the world, Apple, loved failure. Loved it. Because it showed he went for something and didn't hold back. He did what was his to do. And when something didn't work out, he said, "Great!" And he dropped it. He wasn't attached to it. Went on to the next thing. And there's some wonderful failures in the Apple history that could be seen as great tragedies. But it turned out they were the foundation of other great successes. And that's how Steve Jobs held it. There was a computer called the Next Computer, NEXT computer, which was very advanced for its time. It was back in the 90s, I think. Mm-hmm. Way too expensive, beyond most people's needs. It wasn't a success. However, the operating system of that computer became the basis for all Apple computers after Steve Jobs took over the helm again, and has been the foundation of undisturbed mind in success or failure.
So are we then judging it as a success or failure, personally? Because how am I to know
if
what's
we're
a success
attached
or a failure?
To the idea of success or failure, our equanimity of mind is at risk. One way to hold it is that that success and failure are both phantoms. They're both phantoms.
We live here in America. It's very hard to simply change that mindset. It's so ingrained in our culture.
Well, you don't have to change your mindset. You can let spirit change it on your behalf.
It's not easy, but yeah, I understand.
But it sounds like the next computer was not a failure. It was a success because it ended up to be the foundation for the Apple computers. So
the work
who's judging it a success?
All the work that they did to create it, all the pieces of it, all that work was then used mm-hmm. on the Apple
so
computer.
So that sounds like a success, not a failure to me.
Yes, of course. That next computer itself didn't make any money. And they
so that's how it
they
judged success.
They discontinued it. The particulars of the are not really important. What is important is, are we attached to success and failure? And does it influence how we hold ourselves? Have we ever thought of ourselves as a success? Have we ever thought of ourselves as a failure? If you hold yourself in either of those lights, your equanimity is lost.
Got it.
Your equanimity is lost. Can you be a success and be lied about? No? Right? Success today. Who knows what will happen tomorrow? Can you be a failure? Well, that didn't work out so well. Let's see what happens tomorrow. There's other stories of great industrialists who have invested tons of money in endeavors that didn't work out the way they expected. And they used some of the things they learned during those undertakings to make what society looked at as great successes later.
I was just thinking that with attachments and what we're talking about, success and failure, it's not that thing, it's what's underneath it. Like an attachment is never the attachment, it's what is underneath the attachment. So if you recognize that you have an attachment, it's like an opportunity to go look at that and say, okay, what is it that that's telling me? What do I need to work on, really, that's resulting in this attachment? And I think with the success and failure, it's the same thing. Is that, you know, how do I view myself? Who am I? Where do I come from? Mm-hmm.
One of the tools for working on that is the way we name it. Mm-hmm. Way we name it. First of all, we have success failure, which what some people think is success, someone else might think is a failure, and there's that. And there's also the word attachment. If we think we're attached to something, can we train ourselves not to say I'm attached to that, but I have it? It's one thing to be attached to something, our spouses, for example. It's another thing to have something, our spouse, for example. You see, there's a little difference. It's just a little lighter. It's something I have. So whenever we notice that we're attached to something and that idea comes up, we can remember, I'm going to change the way I think about that. I'm going to now say, I have that. So I'm not really attached to my car. Actually, I am. But I'm not really attached to my car. I have a car. And like St. Francis's donkey, it serves me. Brings me to church, takes me here and there. I wash it. I change the oil in it. And it allows me to do what's mine to do.
don't think currently choosing something is another way to say that. Like, I'm attached to the Unity Church. I like it. I'm currently choosing to be here. But I don't have it. I mean, I think I'm just choosing to be here.
Yes.
I think sometimes for me, it's easier for me in terms of success or failure to say, oh, there is success, instead of I have success. You know, so the I is the problem,
yes,
for me most of the time, right? When I could just say, oh, there is success, or there is failure.
So
know?
It's not identified with the I.
Right.
It's like God made a success over there, and I'm noticing it. Thank you.
Right. Yeah.
I'm here to we'll witness it,
or you know, a failure, whatever that might be.
Gee, universe made a failure, and I'm witnessing it.
I like the phrase, you know, that works or that doesn't work.
Mm. Yeah, mm-hmm.
That's, you know.
Mm-hmm. There are various techniques for loosening the emotional grip of I'm a success, I'm a failure, and we choose different ways.
Non-violent communication is the observation without the interpretation or evaluation.
Mm-hmm. Yes, non-violent communication, a wonderful study which helps remove ourselves from these attachments by a process of identifying the facts and the feelings with regard to those facts. And being a witness to those is another technique. Here's an alternate translation, and this is the one that I have memorized because it rings more true to me as poetry. Self-possessed, resolute, act without any thought of results, open to success or failure. This equanimity is yoga. Since I memorized this, it's available to me. And whenever I'm called upon to do something or not do something, I will sometimes bring this to mind. Self-possessed. What's the self? That's my Christ consciousness. Capital S self. Self-possessed. Resolute. When we're resolute, we're not the subject of our emotions or
wishy-washy.
What other people think or wishy-washy. No, this comes from deep. Resolute. My purpose on earth is to serve others. I am resolute in that.
I think I've learned anyhow, in many cases, nothing ever works right the first time. So if you are resolute, it will be a success or it will work right. But you have to keep at it. And when you have that first failure, you realize, okay, this has happened many times before. I'll just keep at it and it'll come out all right.
This was the mentality of Steve Jobs. He was resolute. Nothing would disrupt, and it did not disrupt his thrust. And what was his thrust? His thrust was to make beautiful things that were useful to people. He was resolute in this, to make beautiful things that were useful to people. So if you look at the genesis of Apple products, the Apple Watch, for example, and the Mac computer, so many details that are not particularly associated with the usefulness of the device were thought about and worked over so carefully over a long time, so the product would not only be useful, but beautiful and satisfying in its beauty. He was resolute about that, so success or failure didn't care.
Mm-hmm.
Self-possessed, resolute, act. In other words, don't kick back and say, well, I give up like Arjuna did. No, we need to do what ours to do. Act. without any thought of results, the results we were worried about or feared, and so on. Open to success or failure. Can you be open to failures? Most of us aren't we? We're open to be successful. We're not open for failure. Steve Jobs was open for failure because he was resolute. Open to success or failure. This equanimity is yoga. So we look at some commentary and see what Satchitananda had to say about this. Oh, not yet. Better look at another sloka verse. Here we go. Work done for the sake of some results is much lower than that done in mental equilibrium, Arjuna. Wretched are those motivated by the fruits of their actions.
Yeah.
We talked about this a lot.
Not to your actions, please.
Work done for the sake of some results. Our job is to act for the action's sake. And whatever the results are, be in a state of equanimity and gratitude to God that we're here to witness them. Rather than be upset, it didn't turn out the way we hoped, or shocked, they turned out way beyond our expectations. Have any of you seen the movie A Hard Day's Night by the Beatles? It was made about 40 years ago.
Yeah.
40 years ago, A Hard Day's Night. I got it delivered to my house on a DVD from Netflix, and I've seen it before, and I watched it again. A Hard Day's Night is the story of one day in the life of the Beatles. The requirement for the movie was that it represents some things they did in an imaginary day with some fun things added in, and also that there be 6 new songs that the Beatles would sing during the movie because people wanted to hear them sing, loved to hear them sing, especially the 14, 15-year-olds of the time. They made this movie and they had so much fun. They were just themselves, these young guys, 18, 19, 20. And they were used to goofing off and being natural. So they made the movie with no thought of success or failure. They just had a great time and they ran out in the fields and did somersaults and they made funny faces and replied with sardonic remarks when people asked them, what do you think of this or that or the other. And they had so much fun, they were just infectious. You couldn't help watching them. They couldn't figure out a title for the movie. And John Lennon told the producer, well, Ringo Starr often says nutty things. And one of the nutty things he said was, gosh, we've worked so hard all day long, and then we had a hard day's night. Which doesn't make sense. But the producer thought it was a great title, so he sent the title back to New York for approval. The movie was made in London. And the executive in New York saw the title and went, I don't know. So he asked the executive to check with all the young people on his staff, see what they thought of the title. He did. Called back and said, hey, it's a great time. So the producer then told John Lennon and Paul McCartney, who wrote all the songs, well, it would be nice to have a song to go with It's a Hard Day's Night, rather than just the title. Mm-hmm. And they'd finished shooting the movie. They'd recorded all the songs, they'd done all the shooting, they were just doing the mop-up. And John Lennon said, well, where are we going to use the song? We've recorded all the sessions and done it all. And the producer said, well, we'll use it during the beginning of the movie when you're introduced running around the streets and the crowds of boys and girls following you. And there's this long scene where they run around escaping the crowd. We'll use it there. So Paul McCartney and John Lennon said, okay, we'll work on it. And they went home, and the next morning they showed up, and they had a matchbook with them, and they said, "We've written this song. Can we play it for you now?" And the lyrics were on a matchbook. "It's been a hard day's night. I've been working like a dog. It's been a hard day's night. I wanted to sleep like a log," and so on. And of course, it was a huge success, wasn't it? Just naturalness.
Good story.
And the point of the whole story is, here were some guys who had trouble finding bus fare. And they just did what they did. And it wasn't until before the movie was made, but it was in progress, and they came to the U.S. and got on the Ed Sullivan Show, that they became a worldwide phenomenon. Before that, they were just another poor group. They didn't have any money, trouble finding bus fare. Well, they came back from that and were a huge success. And wow, there were some problems with that success. They lost their privacy. And George Harrison said later on, he said, "You know, there used to be a time when there were so many things I wanted. I wanted this and that. So many things I wanted, but didn't have the money." He said, "And now that I have the money, I didn't really want anything anymore."
Yeah.
So I think in this case, I can see it as like the action is the fruit.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Right?
Yes.
What did they say?
Doing what is ours to do, because it's ours to do, right, and no thought
that's
of results.
The yeah.
That's the fruit. Mm-hmm. Whatever happens. Good observation.
Yeah.
Work done for the sake of some results is much lower than that done in mental equilibrium, Arjuna. Wretched are those motivated by the fruits of their actions. But we'll do the commentary next time.
Mm-hmm.
As long as we don't spend too much time on the verses.
It was very deep, though.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of examples. It was very good.
Yeah.
And your story.
Great.
And,
it was great.
It really helped.
Great.
Thank you.
It was great.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank
Satchidananda,
you
God bless, has some observations as well. We like to close the way we began, by going into our heart space and making the sound of all together. Let's first notice three breaths going in and out. And with a deep in breath. Sanskrit word for equilibrium or spiritual peace. Shanti. Go in Shanti.